Sometimes you just need to touch grass, literally and figuratively. And we recommend you bring books. Tell the bibliologists set tailored book recommendations about what you love and what you don't and what you want to read this summer on your outdoor adventures. You can get your recommendations via email or receive hardcovers in the mail. And TBR has plans for every budget. This summer, touch grass and bring books. You pack the bags, we pick the books. Visit mytbr.co to sign up today. It only takes a few minutes. That's mytbr.co.
On May 1st, 1945, just 6 days before the Nazis would surrender to Allied forces, Fridio Lampa found himself 6 miles outside of Berlin, in the way of the rapidly advancing Soviet army.
He was working as a translator for the Germans after being drafted into service several years before. He had contracted a bone disease in his youth, which left him disabled, and until late in the war, it kept him out of compulsory military service.
But as the war went on and German losses mounted, Lampa was finally pressed into service, if only in a support role.
The front lines were porous at this point, with the Germans in retreat and the Soviets sprinting toward the German capital.
And so it was that Lampa and another man were stopped by an advanced Russian patrol and were asked for their papers.
Lampa was a non-combatant, and so on the presentation of his papers had reason to think he would be left alone as the patrol moved along.
The Soviets, though, believed that SS troops were deserting and trying to blend in to escape being taken prisoner, or worse.
Lampa presented his papers, and the Russians sized him up. And they didn't believe the man in front of them was the person pictured in Lampa's documents.
Over the course of the war, Lampa had lost an enormous amount of weight, both because of rationing and because of his enormous fear for his life and that of his friends. The Soviets walked him to a small clearing and shot him dead and buried him where he fell. At this late stage, prisoners were an encumbrance and no chances were being taken in the face of uncertainty.
After the surrender of Germany, news got back to his friends about what had happened, and they placed a marker on his grave which read, "You are not alone."
Hello and welcome to Annotated. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
And I'm Rebecca Shinsky. In today's episode, we follow the intertwined stories of the writer, librarian, and bookseller Fridio Lampa and the literary front of the Nazis' culture war.
It's, of course, about silencing and erasure, but also about how books and knowledge aren't just casualties in a larger war. They are both the spoils of victory and the cost of losing in their own way.
Sometimes you just need to touch grass, literally and figuratively. And we recommend you bring books. Tell the bibliologists set tailored book recommendations about what you love and what you don't and what you want to read this summer on your outdoor adventures. You can get your recommendations via email or receive hardcovers in the mail. And TBR has plans for every budget. This summer, touch grass and bring books. You pack the bags, we pick the books. Visit mytbr.co to sign up today. It only takes a few minutes. That's mytbr.co.
For several years while working as a bookseller, Simon Betty had been mulling the idea of translating a book. In the course of cataloging and buying and selling, he found all sorts of books that could be interesting projects.
As a bookseller, you know, you're always coming across things. And if you're dealing in foreign languages too, or books in foreign languages, you're always coming across different authors and getting interested in them. And more often than not, there have been translations.
And one day he came across a book called Amran der Nacht by Fridio Lampa, which in English translates to At the Edge of the Night.
For whatever reason, I took out, it wasn't an author that I'd heard of. I was commuting at that time, and I was reading it on the train, and, you know, and I enjoyed it, and I knew that he hadn't been translated. And I think even at that time, I did actually begin a translation during my sort of morning commute.
While Simon was inspired immediately to make some notes, he didn't finally decide to tackle the project for several years.
But this was one that struck me, looked around and saw that really nothing by him had ever appeared in English before. So a few years ago, sort of one summer, I sort of sat down with this book and actually sort of started to actually translate it properly.
The book itself was fascinating, but as he read, Simon became more and more interested in Lampa himself.
And one of the things that's particularly interesting about him is his own, there's sort of two things, his own story as a writer growing up as a young, gay, disabled writer in Germany in the 20s, and then, you know, and then in the early 30s when he actually starts writing himself.
Simon realized that here was a German writer who was beginning his literary career at precisely the same moment that Hitler and the Nazis were coming to power. That his story was one that should be told, and his work should be more widely known.
And so he got into it.
He came from the northwest of Germany, a town called Bremen, sort of harbor city, really, and was very attached to where he came from, and worked there on a sort of family magazine publication.
From a very young age, Lampe wanted to be a writer and so immersed himself in the world of books.
He was a voracious reader. As a teenager, he read, you know, everything and had particular views on literature, was very interested in sort of what was meant to classical writers, whether they were German or French, English, American, Russian. No, he just read it all. I mean, he was reading Kafka as it was coming out, you know, that sort of thing.
After working at the family magazine for a time, he wanted to get into the larger literary scene, so he made a move.
And for that, he then started working in Hamburg, in the sort of town libraries there, working with things there. And at that point, he started mixing in circles with other writers, meeting other people interested in books and people who were writing, and then started to write himself.
As Lampe was joining the literary world, the political world of Germany was changing radically. And for his part, Lampe just tried to stay out of it.
Reading his letters from the time, and I don't feel he's a political person. He didn't join the Nazi Party, but then he wasn't fighting against it either. I think, given his sexuality, I think he just really sort of kept himself to himself during the Nazi period.
He kept his head down writing, and by 1933 was ready to publish At the Edge of the Night. And though he had for so long tried to stay away from the political furor that surrounded him, he could not avoid the attention of the National Socialists any longer. In October of 1933, his book was banned by the Nazis.
He was as surprised as anyone that anyone should want to ban his book, and was like shocked that when it was banned.
In hindsight, he really should not have been shocked, considering how closely the Nazis were scrutinizing books. And there are moments in At the Edge of the Night that caught their attention.
The sort of homoerotic episodes in it, I mean, it's nothing like graphic or anything like that. I mean, it's, you know, there are various characters in there who are gay. But, you know, he certainly wasn't like a gay rights campaigner or anything like that. He was, like, appalled that his book should be put together with pornography or anything like that, because, you know, that isn't what the book's like at all.
At the Edge of the Night is a dreamlike little book, one that feels connected to literary modernism and markedly disconnected from overt politics. In it, Lampe is experimenting with style more than anything else.
The way he crafted it, he was very interested in film, and he conceived the book as film-like. He was viewing it like a camera, and you get this idea of sort of like the camera angles. You can imagine it working as a series of sort of large, long camera shots. There's no one main character, and you know, it's these different threads of plot, as you might get in a film, and then you get, you know, particular characters meeting together. You know, someone will get off a tram and meet someone else, and then they'll walk away, and then the camera, you, the reader, as it were, will follow that person going away from the person that's just been described.
But a couple of scenes depict gay people, and one a mixed-race relationship. Fleeting and not at all dwelt upon, but it's there. And that was enough.
His shock at being banned was an indication of how much Lampe had buried his head in the sand. Just 5 months earlier, the Nazis enacted the most famous book burning of all time.
Yeah, I would like to point out that the book burning on the 10th of May 1933, it wasn't a large destruction, a mass destruction of books. It was mainly an event of symbolic importance.
This is Anders Rydell, who chronicled the destruction, looting, and confiscating of books by the Nazis during World War II.
And for many Germans, they understood what this was about, because they had a historical reference of this. 100 years earlier, German students had burned French books after the Napoleon Wars. But mainly it was a reference to an episode 500 years earlier when Martin Luther burned the papal bull. And in the Nazi point of view, this act of Martin Luther wasn't an act of religious freedom. It was a nationalistic act.
And while At the Edge of the Night wasn't on that pile of burning books, it was banned for the same reason. Lampe's work ran counter to the Nazi idea of German purity.
Nazi book burnings remain a powerful image from World War II, but over time, what they have come to represent is somewhat different from what the Germans were trying to do.
The book burnings and the banning and culling of bookstores and libraries were not just about destroying books and ideas. They were about making space for other books and ideas.
When the Nazis came to power, a lot of intellectuals, academics, and authors, and poets, and artists fled Nazi Germany. But most didn't. They got new money. And you could say that the Nazis created this new kind of cultural policy. The cultural policy that built libraries, they started new prices, scholarships, built operas, theater houses, and I mean, the first official building that the Nazis built was a museum in Munich, the House of the German Art.
And these were not merely public displays or superficial propaganda. This was a front line of the Nazi war on history.
In the Nazi view, they always fought two kinds of wars. It was the classic war on battlefields with soldiers and tanks. And then it was the political war, the war of ideas. And that kind of war was really the most important war. And the soldiers in that war was librarians, poets, academics, the people that could rewrite the history, that could prove that the Nazi conspiracies, the Nazi ideas was true.
The Nazis were trying to rewrite world history, to tell a story of the world that centered Germany. It was a particular and inflexible story, one in which there was no part for Friedio Lampe to play.
In our present cultural imagination, there is a version of Lampe's story that plays out like this. A gay, disabled German writer has his book banned. As the concentration camp machine gears up, he is imprisoned and ultimately killed by the Nazis. It happened to many with Lampe's profile, so why didn't it happen to him?
He was trying to sort of keep himself to himself, keep his head down, certainly after his first book was banned as well. He didn't want to draw attention to himself. And his second book, which is a long poem, which he had privately printed in 1936, that wouldn't have aroused any suspicion or anything like that at all.
Survival rather than literary achievement became paramount. And Lampe knew that he was in danger as he saw his friends and peers get pulled into the war.
I mean, the thing which really affected him was his friends, you know, friends of his who were called up to fight. He wasn't called up because he'd suffered from this sort of bone tuberculosis as a child, so he couldn't walk properly. So therefore, he was never called up to fight himself. But all his friends were. Other friends, you know, sort of writer friends had left Germany at the time. Friends were called up to fight. They went off to war.
And try as he might, the war finally came to him. Lampe was drafted late in the war to do work as a translator, which led to his fatal encounter with Russian troops.
In effect, Lampe self-censored in order to survive, to get along. And it is a story that played out with the wider German people as well.
They banned books, but you could still get books and read forbidden books. But if you wanted, you could, through the whole Nazi area, get some of the forbidden books. The people often destroy them themselves. The largest destruction of books was people that destroyed their own books because they were afraid. So in 1933, I mean, everyone that was afraid, they burned their books and they threw them away. So all over Germany, you could see people that just dumped books in rivers or in alleys or everywhere just to get rid of them. So I think that was also a large destruction that people just wanted. I can't have those books anymore at home.
And some of those books destroyed and cast off by German citizens themselves were certainly copies of Lampe's At the Edge of the Night.
He just wants to be a writer. He just wants to write books, be involved in publishing, and enjoy, you know, reading and writing and literature. And yet the time and the place of where his life happens to be led doesn't work for him, just doesn't work for what he wanted to achieve with him, with his life as a writer and a reader.
Lampe's compromised career is just one small example of what the Nazis wanted to do: disrupt the existing narrative and replace it by violence, theft, and law with their own story.
And I think today we really want to see the Nazis as cultural destroyers, as barbaric, because we want to see the culture and literature and books as a force of good. But I think one lesson of this era is that culture could also be a weapon, and it could be one of the most horrific and dangerous weapons in the wrong hands. It's much more scary. I mean, I'm always more afraid of Nazis that read books than Nazis that don't read books.
And as Simon's work translating Lampe into English for the first time shows, this war is not over. But unlike the millions of lives that were lost, when it comes to books and art, there are still literary and artistic works and legacies that can be saved. And maybe Lampe won't be, in the end, alone.
I'm hoping his luck is, you know, maybe changing now, both in Germany. I mean, although he's recognised, I mean, he has an entry, short entry in the Oxford Companion to German Literature. I mean, he's recognised among German academics that he is, you know, someone who's worth reading and studying. But I think he's not like a household name in Germany at all. I mean, most people in Germany will not have heard of him. I'm hoping in a way that people will find him an interesting author, actually, because if you look back and you look and see what else was being published at the time, early 30s, this does stand out as being and sort of unusual in terms of its structure.
That books survived, even in obscurity, allows these silenced stories to be rediscovered. The endurance of art and its ability to serve as a counter-narrative was something the Nazis were well aware of and planning for.
Adolf Frank, who was in charge of the Nazis' efforts to loot and collect and selectively destroy Jewish literature, had a chilling vision of why policing literature was so important, and it was a vision that spanned generations.
He said that the Nazis' grandchildren maybe could judge them for the Holocaust in the future if they didn't in some way collect the Jewish culture to show their grandchildren how evil the Jews were. So it was important not just to annihilate, to destroy, to eradicate Jews and Jewish culture. It was also important to save something of it as proof of the evil of the Jews.
So it was a program of destruction and fabrication, of silencing and stepping into the silence created to tell a story the Nazis wanted to tell.
And so the work continues of unraveling the lies, the censorship, the erasure, and the eradication. And for his part, Simon thinks that translating Lampe and talking about his work is part of putting back together the story the Nazis wanted gone from history.
And also, I hope for people interested in the history of LGBT writers, you know, he is. So, I mean, I found a German work on the history of sort of gay literature during the Nazi period, and there's a whole chapter on Lampe. The writer there says he really is the only gay author of any sort of real literary merit. He really is a different case. No one really has looked at LGBT, so I'm hoping perhaps the time has come for that.
Some of the books and authors targeted by the Nazis might be gone forever, but there are more books and documents and stories that, like Friedel Lampe, are sitting on shelves waiting to be rediscovered. A lot more.
Just a couple of weeks ago, and I held a lecturing tour in Lithuania, and I visited the National Library, and they're still going through the collections from the war. I mean, they have hundreds and thousands of letters and documents, and the papers I saw, it's like no one had seen them since the war. And there's so much to discover from this era. When I started to write about the Second World War, you had this idea that everything is already written. And there are 10 books about Hitler's dog and everything. When you go down in the archives, I mean, you discover that it's the opposite. Almost nothing has been written. So I really hope that more people dig down to this area because there are so much more to discover.
This episode was written and produced by me, Jeff O'Neill.
Sound editing and design by Kyle O'Neill.
Simon Beatty's translation of At the Edge of the Night is out now from Hesperus Books.
And Anders Rydell's book about the Nazi destruction, banning, and looting of books called The Book Thieves is also out and available wherever books are sold.
You can follow Annotated on Instagram at AnnotatedFM. And after this episode is released, I'll be posting photos of Lampa, his original work, and other material related to this show.
And until next time, read something great.